From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Congress recently passed credit card reform legislation, and President Obama signed it into law. But does it do enough to protect the consumer? On today's Fresh Air, Adam Leventon, who specializes in bankruptcy and commercial law and has testified before Congress. He'll tell us about some of the tricks and traps credit card companies employ and why he thinks laws simply banning certain practices and requiring more disclosure won't work. Also, we remember actor David Carradine. He was found dead in Bangkok, Thailand, where he was making a film. He was 72. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the first CD by mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Chandler Burr's debut novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Last month, President Obama signed into law the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act. It was designed to curb some of the credit card industry's most controversial, some would say abusive, practices. The bill prohibits companies from raising interest rates on existing balances unless a borrower is at least 60 days late, and it requires 45 days' notice before raising any interest rates. It also increases disclosure requirements and limits the company's ability to market credit cards to young people. But our guest Adam Levitin believes the traditional regulatory approach of banning specific practices and requiring more transparency won't effectively rein in companies determined to squeeze customers for more revenue. We invited him in to explain his ideas for an alternative approach to credit card regulation. Adam Levitin is an associate law professor at Georgetown specializing in bankruptcy and commercial law. He's testified before Congress several times on the credit card industry. Adam Levitin, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, a credit card is, in some sense, a way of transacting a loan. I mean, the bank is loaning you money for a purchase. And in most traditional loans, the lender wants the principal back, and they want some interest, and they make money on that. You told Congress in April that what the credit card companies really do is fundamentally different. In a lot of cases, they're not so interested in getting the principal back.
That's right. There are several different business models that operate within the card industry, but one of them is what Ronald Mann at Columbia Law School has termed the sweatbox model. And a sweatbox credit card lender is not looking to get its principal back. Instead, it wants to keep the consumer paying. And the way it does this is that it will loan money to a consumer beyond the consumer's ability to repay in the short term. And even if the consumer never is able to actually repay that principal, the card issuer will still make a profit because the interest rates and the fees on the balance will be so high that it will offset the loss of the principal. And this is a very different business model than anything we've seen in the credit world before, where we have a lender who's making a loan and really not wanting to get paid back. And that starts to look very predatory. If you wanted to go to a sort of a basic definition of predatory lending, it would be lending where with conscious disregard of consumers' ability to repay. And that's exactly what the sweatbox model is. It's saying, we want to keep you forever and locked in as an annuity, that we want you just paying, and never getting out of debt.
Right. So you're kind of, you get on this treadmill where you're just running and generating fees, and in the end, the principal, I mean, doesn't matter so much. When you spoke to Congress in April, you talked to them about what effective reform would be like. And one of the interesting points you made was that all of this talk about providing more transparency, disclosing information in clear, readable English and bold type, as opposed to these dense statements which are utterly inscrutable, that kind of disclosure really is not going to work. Why?
Well, disclosure has been the primary model for credit card regulation since 1968, since we enacted the Truth in Lending Act. And the idea behind disclosure has always been that if you put the information out there so that consumers can see it and understand it, then consumers will make intelligent, responsible choices, that consumers will know whether to use a credit card and which credit card to use. The problem with disclosure as a model for credit card regulation is that it is not very good at dealing with complex financial products. So disclosure might have been a sensible thing when credit cards first appeared, because credit cards used to be pretty simple. They would have a single interest rate and maybe an annual fee, and that was it. Today, however, that's not what credit cards look like. That credit cards have more price points, different types of fees and interest rates, than any other consumer financial product. It's not even close. And the result is that it makes it very hard to do comparison shopping between credit cards. I can very easily look at two different credit cards and compare their purchase interest rate, but that doesn't tell me what the total cost of revolving a balance on the card will be.
What are some of those other ways that you can get smacked, those other price points?
Well, some of them are explicit price points, the things that are actually disclosed up front, things that there is a cash advance interest rate. Well, you have to know what qualifies as a cash advance. So, for example, you'll often get convenience checks with your credit card statement. those checks are subject to the cash advance interest rate, and there may also be an additional fee. None of those fees are actually disclosed on the convenience checks, incidentally. So you get the check, you say, oh, great, I can use this to pay my rent or my utility bill, put it on my credit card. And you don't realize that, well, it's actually at a much higher rate than if you went to the store and purchased some groceries. There are also things like, you know, over-limit fees, late fees. There are foreign transaction fees now. There are all these very direct-to-consumer fees. Some of them are upfront, like annual fees that you know you have to pay. Others are contingent upon your use of the card, like late fees or over-limit fees. There are also fees like interchange fees that are charged to the merchant, but they get passed through to consumers. And then there are a lot of hidden price points, credit card billing practices that effectively goose up the cost of using a credit card without having to have that disclosed. So, for example, a practice called double cycle billing. That double cycle billing means that the balance on which interest accrues is not the balance solely of this current billing period, but it's the average balance of this billing period and the previous one. So if you had a high balance in the previous billing cycle, that means that you were going to, even if your balance is very low in this current cycle, you're going to be paying interest on a very high notional balance. There are tricks and traps like the time on which a payment is credited. You think my payment was received in the mail by the card issuer on the first of the month when it was due. Well, the card issuer might say, well, your payment was received after 2 p.m., so that's actually the next day. And it's late, therefore you get hit with a late fee, and therefore you're going to pay interest. So credit cards have developed over since the Truth in Lending Act into very complex financial instruments with lots of different explicit price points and lots of hidden ones. The result is that disclosure just doesn't work, that you cannot look at a credit card and know what it will cost to revolve a particular balance.
So a typical way of dealing with an abusive practice is to simply ban specific practices. You can't change interest without a certain amount of notice, or you can't change interest rates on a previous balance. But you told Congress in April that this practice of prohibiting specific abuses also is in the end not going to work. Why not?
There are two problems with it. First of all, you can end up playing a game of regulatory whack-a-mole, where Congress says, okay, card issuers, we don't like bad practices A, B, C, and D. You can't do them anymore. The card industry, though, is incredibly innovative and has a tremendous incentive to innovate around regulation. So if you say you can't do practices A, B, and C, card industry will come up with new practices D, E, and F. And those practices may even be worse than the original practices. So, for example, a couple years ago, consumer groups started making a fuss about a practice called universal cross-default. Namely, you default with a creditor other than the credit card, and that triggers a default on your credit card. So you're late on your cable bill, and all of a sudden, that's a default on your credit card bill.
So I'm late on my cable bill, so the rate on my credit card goes up because that's considered a default?
That's right. So you're being late with one creditor, totally unrelated to your credit card, could lead to higher costs for your credit card, even if you've been paying your credit card on time. Credit card issuers respond to this by dropping universal cross-default and adopting a practice called anytime, any reason term changes. So now it's not that you were late on your cable bill, it's, well, we just felt like it. and now your interest rates are higher. This new practice is, you know, broader than universal cross-default. It's actually worse, but card issuers were then able to get up in front of Congress and, you know, stand up and say, we don't do a universal cross-default. Of course not. We stopped doing that a year ago.
So if by banning a specific practice, you're simply going to get all of the really smart MBAs and other people in the companies to work with some new innovation that will be just as predatory, what's the solution? How do you change it?
The solution is to flip the regulatory model on its head. Right now, our regulatory model is do whatever you want except for really bad practices A, B, and C as long as you disclose. And what we need to do is flip this upside down and say you can't do anything except for A, B, and C. So what this would mean would be standardized credit cards. That most of the terms on credit cards, consumers don't know what those terms are and they don't care. The only thing that consumers care about with credit cards is the cost. That's what this product is about. We want there to be price competition, not non-price competition in credit cards. And the way we can do that is to require standardization of most credit card terms and let the market compete its heart out on a few essential price points, namely an interest rate, a transaction fee, and an availability fee. And if we said issuers can only have those three price points and they can charge whatever they want on those three price points, we would get reasonable product differentiation for different types of consumers. So consumers who transact but don't revolve balances, they would want a card with a high interest rate, low transaction fee, low availability fee. And consumers who are planning on revolving balances would want a low interest rate, but they might be willing to have a high availability fee and transaction fee. We get product differentiation, and we would be able to get pretty good price competition. This would start making credit cards a lot more like, you know, the stuff you buy in the grocery store. We can look at the unit price and have the apples-to-apples comparison.
So you're kind of putting the industry in a way in a straitjacket, saying that, you know, forget all this fancy kind of gizmos that you've come up with. You're going to do a simple product, and it's going to be identifiable and disclosed in simple ways. I mean, that kind of sounds to a lot of people like, you know, socialism. It's you're kind of squelching the innovative power of markets and capitalism.
Well, that's correct in that it's squelching some innovative power, but let's be clear about innovation. Innovation is not always a good thing. If you have an innovative product, that can be very good. But innovation in the credit card industry has not been product innovation. It's been pricing innovation. It's been innovation in how to structure the same basic credit product so as to make its price less transparent to consumers. That's where all the innovation in the credit card space has been. And that's been negative innovation. We don't want that kind of innovation. We want to channel the innovation so that it benefits consumers, not that it harms them. And the current regulatory system encourages innovation in figuring out how to do end runs around regulation rather than how to make a cheaper, better product.
We're speaking with Adam Levitin. He's a law professor at Georgetown University, where he specializes in bankruptcy and commercial law. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Adam Levitin. He's an associate professor of law at Georgetown University, where he specializes in bankruptcy and commercial law and has testified numerous times before Congress on issues involving the credit card industry. Well, Adam Levitin, the Congress didn't exactly take your advice and adopt the sweeping models of reform that you would like to see. Congress has enacted a law which makes some changes in the credit card industry. What do you like about this law?
The thing that I think I like the most about it is that it imposes sort of a basic requirement of contract law on the credit card industry. For a while, the credit card industry operated as if it wasn't subject to regular contract law. Basic contract law principle is that penalty fees have to be reasonable in light of the actual and anticipated harms. And if you look at credit card late fees and penalty fees, you know, they're just flat $35 fees. You know, you're late for one penny, and it's going to cost you $35. There's no reasonableness there. Alternatively, you could be late 30 days with, you know, $10,000. It's still $35. So this reasonableness requirement, I think, is an important restoration of basic principles of contract law. Another thing that I like about it is that it really prohibits a lot of retroactive term changes. So a problem that currently exists in the card industry, but this legislation takes care of, is that card issuers can not only change your interest rate or the terms of your credit card, but they can change them retroactively and apply them to existing balances. This law limits card issuers' ability to do that. They can only do that in a few narrow circumstances.
What was not accomplished? What concerns you?
Well, there are a few things that it doesn't address. Firstly, it does not address the interchange fees that are charged to merchants. And, well, it has a little provision saying that the government accounting office is supposed to study these fees.
And that's the transaction fee that Home Depot pays when I use my card, right? To the bank, right. Okay.
That's right. And that fee is pretty significant. And interesting that you mentioned Home Depot. Home Depot paid more to credit card companies in these transaction fees than it spent on healthcare last year. I mean, that's pretty astounding. Mm. For a lot of merchants, this is one of the largest and most rapidly growing costs of doing business. And merchants are not seeing any additional value from these fees as they keep going up and up and up. So it doesn't do anything to address that. And that's a problem because these fees actually encourage consumer usage of cards even when it's not efficient. These fees are used to fund rewards programs. It's very explicit, actually, in card issuer accounting that the rewards programs are taken as a deduction from these transaction fees. And the problem is that if I'm using my credit card because I'm a rewards points junkie and I'm desperate to get a few more frequent flyer miles so I can get that first class upgrade, I might use my credit card more than I otherwise would. And law of large numbers says when you have more people using credit cards more often, you're going to have more people falling into the quicksand of interest rates and fees and who are not able to pay off their balances. So merchants are funding rewards programs, but merchants aren't necessarily seeing any benefit. And people who are not paying with credit cards, people who are paying with debit cards, or people paying with cash, or even with food stamps, are seeing higher prices in order to subsidize rewards programs. And that's pretty regressive.
What does the new law do about marketing to college kids, you know, people under 21?
It has some pretty good restrictions there. If you're under 21 and you want to get a credit card now, you're going to have to either have an over 21 cosigner, or you're going to have to be able to show that you have the financial wherewithal to have a card. So card issuers can't start sending out cards willy-nilly to every 19-year-old. They also can't go to campuses and say, hey, you get a free iPod if you open up a credit card. They're banned now from, you know, distributing inducements to open up credit cards. And they also cannot start sending out pre-screened offers to under 21-year-olds. In other words, if you're under 21 and you want a credit card, you have to come to the card issuer. They can't come to you.
You know, credit card companies, along with a lot of other companies, have gotten better at mining more of our data, how we actually spend our money on, you know, whether we buy alcohol or shop at Target. What are they doing with that information?
They're doing two things with it. First of all, they're selling it. The data is extremely valuable. And secondly, they're analyzing it. They're mining it to figure out consumer behavior patterns. And another way to put that is they're looking for consumer behavioral weaknesses. One example is that the Federal Trade Commission and Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation brought litigation earlier this year against a company called CompuCredit and some of its business partners for various credit card practices. And one of the things that was alleged in the litigation was that CompuCredit was raising rates on people based on where they shopped. So if they saw that you used your credit card to pay for marriage counseling, or that you used it at a massage parlor, or you got your tires retreaded, they'd say, aha, that indicates something to us about this consumer. That indicates that this is a risky consumer. So we're going to raise rates. And some of that seems kind of reasonable from a card issuer's perspective, that if they see a behavioral pattern, they know, why shouldn't they price for it? On the other hand, you can imagine this really starting to interfere with consumer privacy. So imagine you went to the grocery store and the card issuer, if currently they don't get SKU level, the actual item level data. They only know the store, but they're trying actually now to get the item level data in the name of fraud prevention. Say they see that you're purchasing condoms or that you're purchasing antidepressants or something like that. Maybe they say, well, that says something about this type of consumer, and therefore we're going to raise rates. And that's just not something consumers bargain for. That, first of all, most consumers have no idea that what they choose to buy is going to determine the cost of credit for them. And even if they did, I think very few consumers would be comfortable with that. That, you know, as the deal with the credit card company has always been, you charge me an interest rate for my risk, and if I pay and I pay off my balance, and you don't worry about what I'm buying, that's none of your business. Your business is simply make a line of credit available to me. And we're seeing that card issuers' use of behavioral data is really starting to bump up against consumer privacy concerns.
You know, the credit card companies have warned that now that they are restricted in their activities in the industry, and particularly on the fees and charges they can impose on those who are behind on their balances. They say those of us who pay our cards off every month are going to get dinged. There's going to be a higher cost for people with good credit. What about that?
There may be some of that. I think what we're going to see is we're seeing, first of all, a lot of flux in the industry regardless of this legislation. So even before the legislation passed, we had card issuers cutting back on credit limits and raising rates, even on good creditworthy cardholders. So it's going to be hard to just say, you know, it's the legislation's fault. This was happening already. Secondly, we are going to see a reshuffling of the way credit card price structures work. We're going to start to see lots of new fees and just product features. So my best guess is we're going to see something like a high-risk transaction fee. So if you maybe that's, you know, you make a purchase over the internet, that there's an additional charge or something like that. They're going to come up with a bunch of new fees. They're going to start charging fees for things like getting a paper statement. We're probably going to see interest rates go up, but that doesn't mean that the cost has actually gone up. And that's a sort of a nice trick the card industry likes to play, is to say, oh, look, interest rates are higher. This legislation has caused the cost of cards to go up. That's not the case. My best guess is that cost of credit cards is going to remain basically stable, and that we're just going to see card issuers manage to restructure the cost of cards around the legislation. We're going to see some non-creditworthy consumers have a tougher time getting credit, and that may not be a bad thing. That some of these so-called fee harvester cards, where to get a $300 line of credit, you have to pay $150 in fees, those are going to be substantially restricted, and that's probably a very good thing. You know, maybe it's a little paternalistic, but we've seen the problems that unregulated markets can wreak on society with the mortgage market.
Well, Adam Levitin, we're out of time. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Adam Levitin is an associate professor of law at Georgetown University, specializing in bankruptcy and commercial law. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Subaru, with the safety and performance of all-wheel drive on every vehicle. Love. It's what makes a Subaru. From Reprise Records, with Neil Young Archives, Volume 1, 1963 to 1972. Available now on Blu-ray, DVD, or CD. And from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember actor David Carradine, who's died in Bangkok. He was 72. He was part of an acting dynasty family that included his father John and brothers Robert and Keith. He's best known for his starring role in the Kung Fu TV series. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the debut novel, You or Someone Like You, and Lloyd Schwartz reviews the first CD by mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. For some time, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has had his eye on the young American opera singer Joyce DiDonato. She's just released her first CD, and Lloyd has this review.
Aspergetemi, The last time I saw Joyce DiDonato on stage, she was playing Cinderella in Massenet's sweetly lyrical romantic opera. She was touching and lovable, exactly right for the role. So I was surprised to discover that her first recording was an album of Handel arias called Furore, the Italian word for madness or fury, and she plays a number of characters who couldn't be less like Cinderella. Heroines and heroes who are tormented by jealous rages, obsessed with personal and political revenge, or suffering insane despair over the damage they've caused. Even the most gorgeous of these Handel arias have an edge, often created by the tension Handel exploits between the powerful emotional situations and the neoclassical formality of his musical structures, which includes a lot of repetition. During the 19th century and well into the 20th, Handel was ignored because singers didn't understand the dramatic power of these repetitions. In these so-called da capo arias, loosely translated as from the top, there's a long first section, then a change of mood, and then the entire first section is repeated. In productions and on recordings, these arias were often abbreviated, or the repeated section was just eliminated. But in the 1980s, the extraordinary Handel productions of Peter Sellers and the late Craig Smith taught us the way this music communicated obsession, and that these repetitions embodied some of the opera's most intense states of mind. Joyce DiDonato is from that new generation of singers who understands the nature of these repetitions. In Ario Dante's great tragic aria, Scherza Infida, the hero laments his betrayal and warns the woman he believes is unfaithful that he'll return to haunt her after his death. But in the repeat, Joyce DiDonato not only projects Ario Dante's increased anguish, we can practically hear him turning into a ghost.
Thank you.
Joyce DiDonato is a strong vocal actress. She's as impressive in her quiet singing as in her brilliant coloratura, and she makes distinctions between characters who are demented or just plain angry or sad. In one of these arias, she seems to be trying too hard. Dejanira in Hercules is one of Handel's great operatic roles. There's a new live recording of arias from Hercules sung by the late Lorraine Hunt Lieberson in 1999, conducted by Craig Smith. Her Dejanira is a grand and heartbreaking tragic figure. But DiDonato, in her effort to show us Dejanira's madness, makes her sound more like a witch than a madwoman. But in an aria from Handel's Julius Caesar, DiDonato is right on target. She plays Sesto, the son of Pompey, who has just been assassinated by one of Caesar's henchmen. In this revenge aria, Sesto is a kind of younger Hamlet, trying to convince himself to take action. Conductor Christophe Rousset and his period instrument group understand that Handel's music is depicting the way Sesto is being strangled by his conflicting feelings. Even snakes, Sesto sings, are not satisfied until they have injected venom into their attacker's blood. And Handel lets us hear the venom of revenge that is also trickling into Sesto's own blood. Joyce DiDonato has made a brave debut by presenting some of the most difficult music ever written for a singer. I can't wait to hear what she does next.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed Furore, a new album of Handel arias sung by Joyce DiDonato. Coming up, we remember actor David Carradine, who's died in Bangkok. This is Fresh Air. We learned this morning that actor David Carradine has died in Bangkok, where he was shooting a film. Thai police said he was found dead in his hotel room. He was 72. Carradine appeared in more than 100 films, including Bound for Glory, where he played Woody Guthrie, the Quentin Tarantino films Kill Bill, Volumes 1 and 2, and The Long Riders, where he appeared with his brothers Keith and Robert. David Carradine was the son of actor John Carradine. He rose to fame in the 1970s when he starred in the ABC series Kung Fu. He played Kane, a half-Chinese, half-American, who was brought up in China in a Shaolin monastery where he learned Kung Fu as part of his training. The series followed Kane's adventures as he wandered through the American West, using Kung Fu on the bad guys and passing on ancient wisdom. Terry spoke to David Carradine in 1991 when he'd written a book called The Spirit of Shaolin, about the Kung Fu TV series and the history of the martial art. She asked him what role Kung Fu had played in his life off camera.
Well, it's had certainly an effect on me. It's not always easy to say exactly what, but it's changed my road for sure. And since it's not over yet, I can't tell you where the path is going to lead, but it's made me concentrate on things that maybe I wouldn't have in the first place. You know, I began as a Shakespearean actor, and the directions I thought I would go in turn out not to be the directions I am going in. But I think that's true of anybody's life.
You spend part of your new book talking about things that happened behind the scenes in the TV series Kung Fu. Did they do anything to try to make you look part Chinese?
Yeah, they put a little tiny corner at the inside of my eyes that made my eyes look slightly more Oriental, and they painted me yellow.
Oh, really?
And also, I bent my legs a little bit most of the time, so I didn't look so tall.
Huh, how tall are you?
I'm 6'2".
Uh-huh. When Kung Fu was first on, I was taking Taekwondo lessons. Taekwondo is a Korean form of karate. And in our Monday class, our teacher would always make some comment about the previous episode of Kung Fu, about how the fights were just so improbable that you wouldn't be able to stay alive through one of those fights. You'd have so many broken limbs, you wouldn't be able to function and come back for more. I'm wondering what you think.
Well, you know, right in front of you, I wouldn't want to tell you that your master doesn't necessarily know what he's talking about. But we were looking for realism. We were looking to more illustrate the possibilities of the various forms of Kung Fu than we were actually trying to just simply show you a fight. I mean, you might say, on the other hand, you know, this is a form of entertainment, that the fights were closer to the fights that you see in, say, West Side Story than what you would see in an arena. But I think, you know, the modern things that you see now with Van Damme and those people are even more so in that way, that one of those punches would, you know, crack your clavicle or break your skull or something like that, knock all your teeth out. But I really think, really, in Kung Fu, that we stressed the softness more than we stressed anything else. I think Bruce Lee's version of it, or, you know, these modern guys, is much more unbelievable in terms of people getting hurt. You know, we basically tried to show that Kwai Chang Kang was not trying to hurt people. He was just trying to stop the violence. A lot of that had to do with the fact that the FCC said that they didn't want me to kill people. And we had to make some kind of adjustment.
Yeah, let me bring up here something I found really interesting, that the FCC used to limit the number of minutes per show that you could fight. And they objected to you killing people on the show, too?
Yeah. See, now, we didn't really have an attitude ourselves. We just thought we were doing a good show. And we hated the fact that we'd do these great fights, and then the FCC would say, well, you got to cut this out and cut that out and all that. And some of the things that are the absolute identifying characteristics of the show were produced as a result of these things. For instance, the slow motion created a softer look, and the FCC would be more happy about it. And that's also why we went to so many training sequences, because that way we could do the moves and it would not be thought of as violent.
You not only did the Kung Fu TV series, but you did a lot of films in which you perform martial arts. I'm wondering if over the years a lot of people have come up to you on the street and tried to pick a fight with you just to test themselves against your skills.
Well, a few, yeah. That's happened. I've never gotten any real trouble, but there were certainly some people that tried to give me some. One of the convenient things about Kung Fu mastery is that real Kung Fu masters are very unlikely to try to pick a fight with you. It's usually punks, more or less. But there were a couple of times when the numbers were really kind of large. You know, if you got 9 rednecks walking across the street to pick a fight with you, that does kind of get formidable.
So tell me what happened in that instance and what you did.
Well, you get out of it any way you can. You know, the first rule when faced with a superior opponent is run away. And I did some of that, and sometimes I was able to make a couple of moves that were impressive enough so that people backed off, and sometimes I was able to just change it from a confrontation to something like an autograph session.
You write that the reason why you were able to perform the Kung Fu parts on TV so well was that you loved dance, and you had the body and the flexibility to really do this kind of stuff. You loved dance as a child, but you say your father, the actor John Carradine, wouldn't let you take dance classes. Why not? What kind of problem did he have with dance?
Well, the way he put it was, he said, "No son of mine will make his living with his feet." And that just shows you that destiny is inescapable, because what I ended up doing instead of tapping around was kicking people.
So did you sneak in dance lessons behind his back?
More or less, yes.
What kind?
Well, I studied ballet and I studied tap and I studied a lot of ethnic forms as well.
How close did you get to performing that kind of dance, any of those kinds?
I performed it a lot.
Musicals or?
Yeah, musicals and ballet and I had a band for a long time where I performed on stage, and one of the numbers was that I would tap dance down into the audience and around and on tables and stuff like that.
Did seeing the example of your father and his acting career make you want to act, or did that give you reservations about becoming an actor?
Both. I had reservations. I saw how much pain is involved and how much artifice and how much of it, how much of the business part of it I would probably never understand, as I saw my father going through these problems. Also, part of the reason why I went into an acting career was to finish the job he'd started, because he always felt he didn't go as far as he could. And as a matter of fact, it was kind of a revenge motif that started me out in it. I wanted to get even with these guys for not giving my father what he wanted. And to a certain extent, I guess I've accomplished that, and to a certain extent, I haven't. But then, you know, that's part of the story we were always trying to tell, was that, you know, revenge doesn't work. It belongs to the Lord.
I read all these things about the people I'm interviewing, and I never know what's true and what's not. But I read somewhere that you shot yourself accidentally with a Colt 45 while shooting a scene in
sure
a film.
Sure did.
Did you shoot yourself with a blank or with an actual bullet?
No, you don't use actual bullets in movies unless you're completely insane.
Right.
Which, by the way, certain people are.
Right.
Henry Hathaway did a picture once, a war movie, in which he wanted to have tracer bullets. But by and large, you don't do that. But point-blank range, a blank can actually kill you. It didn't kill me. I have a tough groin.
Ooh.
I mean, I was shot in the groin. But it did ruin a perfectly good tattoo.
Oh, jeez. So you have a scar in the middle of the tattoo?
The butterfly now has a rather ragged wing. Let's put it that way.
Well, I can say is, if you shot yourself in the groin and that tattoo was the worst of the problems, you're really lucky. How do you do scenes now with guns differently than you did that time you were hurt? Was there a lesson that you learned about handling a gun?
Well, I've always been pretty good at handling a gun. The problem was, we were in a real hurry. And the way I was using the guns, I had to repeat what I'd done in an earlier scene. And it was dangerous. We all knew it was dangerous. You take a lot of chances in movies. Look, in these kung fu movies, I have broken or dislocated virtually every finger and every toe that I have. I've crushed my ribs, I've smashed my shoulder, I've destroyed a ligament in the knee. I could go on. Acting is a dangerous profession. And when you consider I've made 68 features, plus all the television and everything, you just got to expect that I'm going to hurt myself now and then. It's sort of like being a football player or something.
Well, David Carradine, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, hey, I want to thank you a lot for allowing me to.
David Carradine speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Carradine has died in Bangkok, where he was making a film. He was 72. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on the debut novel of the New York Times scent critic, Chandler Burr. This is Fresh Air. On the face of it, Chandler Burr surely has one of journalism's most curious jobs. He's the New York Times scent critic. He's also written nonfiction books about the olfactory realm, like The Perfect Scent and The Emperor of Scent. But book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Burr's debut novel, called You or Someone Like You, noses down a thornier path. Here's her review.
Chandler Burr's debut novel, You or Someone Like You, is a must-read for any book group serious enough to spend more time discussing the book rather than what wine to serve at their meeting. Burr's novel is about just such a serious book group, one that tackles off-road authors like William Golding, Anthony Trollope, William Blake, and Christina Rossetti. The group is formed in Hollywood, of all places, where, as our main character observes, people talk on the phone all day long and thus put an immense value on language, yet have an utter disdain for the written word. But the book group plot constitutes only one of the unfolding stories in this smart novel, which is primarily a very tough reflection on the idea of groupness itself. Who's in and who's out, who's considered a full person and who's not. You or Someone Like You is sure to stir up controversy because it doesn't just stick to the safe pieties of decrying discrimination in terms of race or gender. Instead, it confronts what it sees as a more socially acceptable form of discrimination practiced by organized religion, specifically here, Judaism. Even raising the issue of whether Jewish solidarity is a form of self-preservation or exclusivity probably will invite accusations of anti-Semitism to be tossed at this novel. But Burr, like his main character Anne Rosenbaum, clearly subscribes to the view that one distinguishing mark of a good piece of literature is that it doesn't set out to please everybody. The gist of the story is this. Anne and her husband Howard met decades ago at Columbia University. Both were word-drunk English majors. Anne was a transplanted English Protestant girl. Howard hailed from an Orthodox family in Brooklyn. Against his parents' protests, they married. When the novel opens, they've been living in Hollywood for decades, where Howard is a movie studio wheeler-dealer with ties to the New York literary world, and the more retiring Anne takes pleasure in books and her garden. During a business dinner, a studio exec turns to Anne, who's renowned for always carrying a book with her, and proposes that she make up a recommended reading list. The list circulates, and soon Anne finds herself leading book groups where the likes of producers and script doctors are going mano a mano about Mansfield Park. Naturally, Burr can't resist cracking jokes about book group eating rituals. Anne tells us that the unwritten rule was that the participants brought dessert. In typical industry fashion, like emerging nuclear powers, they rapidly escalated the desserts in intricacy and number and size and exoticism and, quite predictably, cost. The Virginia Woolf dessert was appropriate in size, small, but it cost $800 and came in four cream-colored bamboo boxes lined in silver paper and tied with raw Andalusian hemp. While Anne has her head in books, Howard, reacting to a deep family insult, finds himself drawn back more and more into the world of Orthodox Judaism that he left when he married Anne. She fiercely tries to hold on to him, and when he shuts her out, she communicates to him through the literature of her book clubs. Anne sees herself as a universalist, like her beloved W.H. Auden, who left England to settle in a chaotic New York. Even as Howard engages in a search for origins, Anne defiantly counters with Auden's view that home is the place you choose. Literary as she may be, she also flings unpoetic words like tribalism, racism, and bigotry at the increasingly reclusive Howard. When does cultural pride transform into cultural arrogance? It's an uneasy question we consider daily in this mixed-up democracy of ours, most recently with the controversy over whether Sonia Sotomayor's Hispanic Pride remarks are or are not racist. Chandler Burr's provocative new novel weighs in on the issue of identity politics and also makes a powerful case for why great books are a great danger to small minds.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed You Or Someone Like You by Chandler Burr. You can download podcasts of our show at our website, freshair.npr.org. Coco Taylor, a blues vocalist icon, died Wednesday in her hometown of Chicago. She sang such hits as I'm a Woman and Hey Bartender. Taylor died from complications of gastrointestinal surgery. We'll close with her 1965 hit, Wang Dang Doodle. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Tell Automatic Slim, tell Razor Toting Jim, tell Butcher Knife Toting Nanny, tell Fast Talking Fanny. We gonna pitch a ball down to that Union Hall. We gonna Trump till midnight. We gonna fuss and fight till daylight. Are we gonna pitch a wing and doodle all night long? All night long.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids, families, and communities succeed at aecf.org. From Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, tracking the jobs, companies, and innovations behind America's clean energy economy at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, glamour, debauchery, and high-stakes gambling in Havana, and how mobsters like Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano raked in vast profits from hotels, casinos, and nightclubs before Castro's revolution shut them down. We'll talk with T.J. English, author of Havana Nocturne, which comes out in paperback next week. Join us.